Call Solar and Outdoor Resources Finance Division meeting will come to order Monday, March 30th. Last week I sent Mr. Mike Kilgore, the chair of the Lassard Outdoor Heritage Council, a letter and invited him to our committee meeting today to tell us about the deliberation and decision-making process of the Lassard Outdoor Heritage Committee or Council and their many successes and how their recommendations meet our constitutional amendment investment goals. And we're also interested in hearing about the vision of the council for the future. And I said that because House File 2131 and House File 2132, which are the Hansen and Gunther bills from the Lassard Outdoor Heritage Council, were not in our possession, that we would not talk about the details of their recommendations tonight, but we just want an overview of what the Lassard Outdoor Heritage Council did and where they think they're going. And we welcome you, and members of the committee will listen attentively. We do have five bills that will be briefly heard tonight after your presentation, and I would think that your presentation could take up to 25 to 30 minutes. I understand there's something important going on that members want to go to tonight, and so I have the finish time in my mind of 5:30. So, welcome to the committee, Mr. Kilgore, and will you introduce your guests?
Representative Murphy and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Mike Kilgore. I am the chair of the Lassard Outdoor Heritage Council, and I want to introduce other council members and staff that are here with me today. To my immediate right, your left, is Mr. Jim Cox, who is the vice chair of the Lassard Council. To his right is Mr. Bill Becker, who is working as the staff for the council. Behind me we have Darby Nelson. Dr. Nelson, former state representative, is a member of the council and also appointed by the speaker. And Mr. Bob Schroeder behind me, a member of the council. Senator Bill Ingebrigtsen, one of the two Senate members appointed by the majority leader, and Representative Hansen representing the House, and Representative Gunther, I do not see him. So we have a number of council members here today.
Well, thank you for coming, and thank you, council members, for attending also. Representative Nelson, we're glad that you're back with us in a different capacity, but still contributing, and we appreciate that a lot. I enjoyed working with you when you were here. And to all of you that have been devoting so many hours and days on the Lassard Outdoor Heritage Council, we have deep respect for your work, and we appreciate the time that you put in. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Kilgore.
Madam Chair and members, there is a handout, a PowerPoint slide that will be the basis for the conversation for the next 15 or 20 minutes. I'm going to go through those fairly quickly. There's a lot of material here, but certainly we can go back and deal with specific questions you have. We're going to cover a lot of ground and hopefully respond to the request of the chair regarding the focus of what we've done in terms of process, very light on outcomes, talk about, as we see it, the strengths of the process to date and how it matches up with your division's objectives.
Thank you. And members, we'll let Ms. Kilgore go through his discussion with us, and then we'll take questions after he's completed.
Members, on the screen you'll see the website. We do have a website for the Lassard Outdoor Heritage Council that includes almost all the information you might want to know regarding meeting minutes, tapes of meetings, background materials, presentations made to the council, so I would encourage you to look at that information. By way of background, I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Forest Resources. My area of expertise is in natural resource economics and policy. So I'm over on the St. Paul campus. I'm also the director of the university's graduate studies program for natural resource science and management, which includes roughly 100 PhD and master's students studying in the areas of forest resources, wildlife ecology and management, and wood and paper science. So just very briefly, we have a 12-member council, four legislators and eight citizens. I mentioned the individuals today that are here. You can see that we have four, each appointed by the Speaker, the Majority Leader in the Senate, and the Governor. I'm the Chair. We have the Vice Chair, Jim Cox. Darby Nelson is the Secretary, and Dave Hartwell is the Treasurer. That constitutes the Executive Committee of the Council, and Representative Hansen serves, I think, as the legislative member of that committee. The mission for the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council is, in our view, very clear. It comes directly from the Constitution, Article 11, Section 15, which says the recommendations to you are to do these three things: to restore, protect, and enhance in four resource areas: our wetlands, our prairies, our forests, and the habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. We view the mission of the council to be specific with respect to the uses of the Outdoor Heritage Fund. Again, our council was established last year under 97A.056. I won't go through the detail, but just a couple high points. We are to make annual recommendations to the legislature. We are advisory to you. We were convened on the 1st of December. We were directed to have our first set of recommendations to you by this Wednesday. We actually transmitted those recommendations in the form of two bills to the Speaker last Wednesday afternoon, so we're a bit ahead of schedule on that. The council, in addition to advising you on appropriations from the Outdoor Heritage Fund, we are directed to establish a conservation partners program. And 97A also, since we are part of the legislative branch of government, there are a number of elements dealing with conflict of interest, audit procedures, oversight of the fund, the council, and its staff, and importantly, that we are to make annual recommendations to the legislature. After this first year, those recommendations are due January 15th. Just to let you know, we've had 55 hours roughly of meetings over the 14 public meetings we've held since the 1st of December. I won't go through them all. You can see we've had 9 full council meetings, 2 meetings of a governance committee to get us up and running and to get some structure to the council, and then 3 meetings of our Conservation Partners Grant Committee. We spent a lot of time early on as a council reviewing a variety of information. You will see we spent quite a bit of time getting briefed on the open meeting law. And members, just to let you know, the open meeting law that applies to the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council is the same open meeting law that applies to local units of government, not state legislature, but local units of government. We got briefed on conflict of interest policies and procedures. We were briefed by the Minnesota Department of Management and Budget on the Outdoor Heritage Fund, not only the projections of money coming into the fund, but how the fund works, the mechanics of the deposits going into the fund, going out of the fund. We invited and got a briefing from the legislative auditor, Mr. Jim Nobles, about auditing policies and protocols regarding the fund and the elements specific to 97A. We received briefing from the Department of Administration and also from the DNR on the small grants program, because we are required to develop one. Here are a list of 7 guiding principles. I'm not going to describe those in detail, but I think the first one really is important, that our work, we view it as really to be guided by science and the best practices regarding resource management. We have a number of these. These were embodied in our process document that I'm going to talk about in a bit, but just to let you know, we as a council view our role to try and identify where the greatest conservation needs are based on what science and best practices are telling us. We spent quite a bit of time reviewing existing plans. When we first convened, we knew we had less than 4 months to put together our first set of recommendations. To get everyone up to speed, we invited individuals to brief us on a number of conservation plans. We started with 3 statewide strategic plans: the LCCMR, Minnesota Conservation and Preservation Plan. In fact, I had some work on that when I was at the university professor. We also were briefed on the Conservation Legacy Council Plan, which was developed a couple years ago, and another statewide strategic plan. So that really set a framework for statewide, what are the pressing conservation natural resource issues. We then drilled down, and I didn't enumerate them all, but just to let you know, we spent a considerable amount of time having background presentations on existing prairies and wetland plans, forest plans, fish and wildlife plans, and other types of plans. If you go to our website, you'll see some of the background information that was provided to us. We spent probably 8 hours in one meeting simply reviewing plans to get a sense of what's out there now. And Madam Chair and members, I will tell you that I had looked at many of these plans, but not nearly in the detail I had prior to serving on the council. And I will tell you that these plans are very thoughtful plans. They're collaboratively developed. They may be published by the Department of Natural Resources, but for example, in a wetlands plan, you will see a number of partners are involved in that plan, public, private, nonprofit. We also spent some time understanding how we deliver conservation in Minnesota. So for the areas that are in the Constitution for the use of this fund of protection, enhancement, and restoration, we got background information about what does it take to actually acquire property for public purposes. Conservation easements are an important part of protection. What is a conservation easement? What's the process for securing a conservation easement? What rights are given up? What rights are withheld? Habitat restoration and enhancement work. And the focus on all of those deliveries of conservation, three things. Who does this work? What do they do? And how do they do them? So we brought folks in from the Department of Natural Resources, from federal agencies, from nonprofit organizations to get a better understanding of how, in fact, do you restore a wetland, or how do you protect a forest through the use of a conservation easement? We reached out to the public. We have a, as I mentioned at the outset, a website for the public to review what information we are reviewing to provide an opportunity for public input. Mr. Bill Becker pulled together some information last Friday. To date, or last Friday, we had about 36,000 hits on the website. We've had public meetings that all the meetings have been noticed. Again, we're subject to open meeting laws, and we provide public an opportunity to comment at those meetings. All of us as members and staff have made various presentations. I would guess I've made no less than 12, maybe 15 presentations describing the work of the council. Other members have done similar efforts. The Board of Water and Soil Resources, not at our request, but on our behalf, held 7 regional listening sessions around the state to get input to us about what the public and local conservation groups and individuals see are the pressing needs in habitat work. And that information was provided to us not only in written form, but also in an oral presentation session. And also, as we move through this first process, we encourage the conservation community to work collaboratively to develop proposal ideas, and I'll talk about that in a bit, in the areas of prairies, wetlands, forests, and fishing and wildlife habitat. So those are some of the outreach activities that we engaged over the first few months of the council. How did we go about and develop our first set of recommendations? We put together a document that described not only our principles of operation, but also 15 minimum criteria that the council indicated that it would look at for any proposal. We identified 6 priority criteria. We were focusing on, in somewhat of an overused phrase now, but truly shovel-ready projects. Conservation, habitat work that was ready to go. The due diligence had been given. All that was lacking was the funding. And so this wasn't just an idea, but there were projects. For example, if it was a conservation easement, that there was a willing seller, that the negotiations had started or were largely through, and all that was needed was the funding. And again, we encouraged, did not require, but we encouraged the conservation community to develop collaborative proposals and to encourage leveraging of non-state funds in their proposals. What happened? We reviewed just under 100 proposals, given our framework of our 15 minimum criteria, that totaled about $250 million. So my take on this, obviously a great need. I will tell you that many of the individuals said that the proposal request was disappointing. It could have been much higher, but given the nature of the amount of money available, they restricted what they were requesting this first year. I guess I've known this, but it sure was borne out in this first round that Minnesota does truly have a tremendous conservation community. I work in my day job as a professor and a researcher with states around the country, literally around the world, and it is widely known that Minnesota is a leader in conservation, and this certainly is bearing itself out. I'm not going to talk about outcomes now. We don't have a bill before us, but just to let you know, remember the Constitution says three activities can be funded from the Outdoor Heritage Fund: protection, restoration, and enhancement. And the four resource areas that would receive that protection, enhancement, or restoration are prairies, wetlands, forests, and fish and game and wildlife habitat. So this 3x4 matrix just indicates the amount of requests that came in along those lines of the resource systems and the resource activities. Again, we don't have a bill in front of us, but just to let you know that the recommendations that you will be seeing shortly is to build protection, enhancement, and restoration capacity in this state. Of the 99, we are recommending 18 programs or projects be funded, totaling about $65 million. We are required to establish a conservation partners program. We are recommending initially $4 million for that program. And the purpose is to engage conservation at a localized level through a rod and gun club, through a nonprofit organization, an effort to build that conservation capacity. We also are recommending, because the fund has no money and will not start receiving deposits until mid-August, that 10% be set aside this first year as a reserve to manage cash flow and uncertainty about what the actual amounts coming into the fund would be. So that's roughly $7.7 million. Outcomes, just very briefly, our recommendations would protect 210,000 acres. The vast majority of that is by conservation easements. 8,700 would be by fee acquisition. Roughly 22,000 acres would be enhanced or restored, roughly equal between those two activities, and greater than 300 miles of shoreline would be protected. Members, just another graphic way of looking at the distribution of the outcomes. So you can see that in the area of protection, that includes acquiring land by fee title, as well as by permanent conservation easement, as well as enhancement and restoration activities across the four resource systems. This is a map that illustrates where these activities would be occurring around the state. It is not, and I repeat, it is not a complete map. One of the major projects that we are recommending funding for around $9 million is the WRP RIM program. That's we do not have sign-ups yet for that, so we can't tell you where those activities will be. But this is a minimum of where the project dollars would occur. Across, there are some 77 counties that are represented in total for our recommendation for the Outdoor Heritage Fund this first fiscal year. In terms of leveraging of non-state dollars, for every $1 of Outdoor Heritage Fund, that would leverage approximately 50 cents of non-state funds. As I mentioned, we have projects that are just geographically dispersed. At least 77 counties would be recipients of the funds, likely more, as well as all seven metro counties would receive outdoor heritage funding. Madam Chair, in response to your specific request about reflect back on what worked well, and I will tell you these are my own personal thoughts. We haven't had a chance to talk to other council members. They certainly can weigh in on it. But I think a first highlight is the fact that early on the council developed a written document that said, here are principles by which we will operate, number one. Number two, here are some explicit criteria that we will use to evaluate proposals. And three, here's the process, including our briefings of background information review of plans from the time we adopted that in early January through April 1. We laid out our schedule of what we plan to do so that the public and its people interested in following this knew where we were in the process and what the next step was. I think that was very helpful in hindsight in letting our conservation community and the public know where we are and where we were going, at least through April 1. A second, I would say, highlight is the council's commitment as to the role that science plays in our decision-making process. Our council process was guided by science, and it really, through the habitat plans that we reviewed and the expertise on the council, focused on where those habitat and conservation needs were the greatest. And I do think that that really was a guiding principle in all of what we have done. We spent, as I mentioned, a lot of time up front. I know that that was somewhat risky because we knew we had a limited, compressed time to develop our recommendations, but we devoted a lot of time to reviewing plans. Maybe some council members might say too much time, but I think it paid big dividends because we needed to understand what those plans were, what the goals were from those plans, and equally how we deliver conservation in this state if we were going to be successful in making thoughtful recommendations to you. I think we've done that. The conservation partner collaboration. We said we encourage, we don't require, but we encourage people to work together in developing these proposals around wetland protection, restoration, and enhancement, prairie restoration, enhancement, and protection, and so forth. I think that worked very well. The feedback I got from those involved was that the conservation partners answered that call. They were very enthusiastic. People were willing on their own to step up to the plate to organize these efforts. I heard positive feedback about developing better working relationships between these organizations and better coordination of the proposals. Madam Chair, the last thing you asked me to respond to, and then we can move on to questions, was you have developed as a division investment goals of the Constitutional Fund. Again, these are my own thoughts. These are not necessarily the thoughts of the council, but my reflection on whether or not, kind of taking them in order, the 12 meets all constitutional and legal requirements. We view our recommendations as being explicitly guided by the constitutional mission of the fund and the work of the council, guided by 897A, and we believe we've met both the procedural and the governance requirements of 97A. Regarding use of existing funding systems, you will see when the bill is before you that we really are building capacity for restoration and enhancement and protection work and building on existing delivery systems, and that can be partnerships, that can be sole organizations. Increase the percentage of Minnesotans who participate in the enjoyment, use, and maintenance of our cultural and outdoor resources. While that's not an explicit constitutional purpose of the Outdoor Heritage Fund, it certainly will be an outcome, a byproduct, in the sense that the Constitution says that any land acquired by fee title through use of the fund needs to be open to public hunting and fishing unless otherwise specified by law. So by virtue of that statement in the Constitution, we believe that that will enhance the participation of Minnesotans in our outdoor resources, whether it be for hunting, fishing, bird watching, or whatever. Creating a plan, number four, for each fund. Minnesota statutes that create the council direct us to take into consideration the outcomes of the Minnesota Conservation and Preservation Plan. We have done that. If you were to look at our accomplishment report that we have asked of all of our project proposers, as well as those who we are recommending for receipt of the fund, they have laid out specific outcomes and aligning those outcomes with the Minnesota Conservation and Preservation Plan, as well as other habitat or resource-specific plans. For example, Wetland Recovery Plan, Prairie Protection Plan. That's all in our accomplishment report. Prevention, number five, of pollution and restore impaired waters. Again, not explicit in the Outdoor Heritage Fund, but by virtue of protecting and enhancing our wetlands, prairies, and forests, and fish game habitat, we believe this will be a very common byproduct of the investments the state makes. Provide every Minnesotan greater access. Again, our mission is to focus on enhancing the habitat for wildlife and fishery populations. Again, a byproduct of that will be, we believe, enhanced use and enjoyment of those resources by virtue of the protection, enhancement, and restoration activities. Develop and use indicators of success. Again, our mission is three activities, protection, restoration, and enhancement for systems, prairies, wetlands, forests, fish and game habitat. We have asked all of our project proposers and those who we are recommending for receipt of the funds to identify specific outcomes related to every one of those activities. So, for example, the number of acres of native prairie protected, if that in fact is a native prairie protection project. Number of acres of forest that is protected, if that is a specific outcome of that project. So, if in fact our recommendations that we have for appropriations occur, we will be able to deliver on specific metrics of acres, miles of shoreline protected, enhanced, restored in those areas. Strive to meet statewide priorities and values. Certainly, we're trying to do that in a balanced manner. And again, as we look at those four resource areas and the three activities, we try to make a balance. One thing the council recognized through this process is there is a tremendous need in conservation in the state. This is a first-year attempt. It's a first year of a 25-year endeavor. So while you look at the first recommendations, you would see, well, you know, maybe it's weighted a little bit more in forests or in prairies and not as much in wetlands and whatever. But our view is that We're trying to address those in identifying the greatest needs first, but certainly there are a lot of worthy projects we simply couldn't fund. 99 proposals submitted, only 18 were recommended for funding. Number 9, giving priority to projects that improve the state's regional, our state economy. Well, if we're going to protect land, we need appraisals done. We need lawyers to do closing. If we're going to do restoration or enhancement, we're certainly going to be needing individuals out on the ground breaking tile or restoring a native prairie. And so, while not explicit again from the use of the fund, the recommendations will certainly create additional employment opportunities by virtue of these activities. Increase outreach and encourage participation. I mentioned earlier the Conservation Partners Program that the council is required to establish. I view this as a real central theme for encouraging locally based conservation efforts around the state. And I would hope, again, we won't know, this is a new program, but it's my hope, and I believe the council's hope, that this will engage conservation at a local level. Number 11, develop innovative uses of the fund. The collaboration that we talked about through the different conservation partners, I think, was the first step. We gave preference to organizations that were collaborative, and you will see when you have the bill in front of you a number of recommendations that include multiple partners working to, let's say, restore wetlands. Last one, communicate through visible identification. We are certainly striving for a transparent process, members, a process where the public not only knows what we're doing but anticipates what we will be doing. We have a website. We provide an opportunity on the website for the public not only to see what we're doing but to provide comments to the council. And it's certainly our goal to make sure the public understands how the Outdoor Heritage Fund dollars are being spent and what specifically the outcomes of those expenditures are. And Madam Chair and members, I apologize, that is a lot of information, but I will now stand for questions. And again, we have several members of the council here, and there may be opportunities for them to provide answers. And so you certainly can direct the questions at any of the members or the staff.
Thank you. Mr. Kilgore, how did you get picked?
How did I get picked? I got a call one night from the Senate Majority Leader, Senator Polgemiller, who at home, and said, would you be interested in serving on this council? And I had served 2 years prior on the Conservation Legacy Council, which had a similar focus, but it was more in terms of governance of natural resource management in the state. I told the majority leader that I would, after conferring with my wife and talking to my employer, the University of Minnesota, and they encouraged me. They thought this, of course, as a university faculty member, we have three responsibilities: teaching, research, and service. They felt this was a great service opportunity. So given the family check-in and the check-in with my employer, I agreed to do so.
Okay. But then how did you get picked to be chair?
That's a great question. I really don't know, except that at the first meeting, my name was recommended as a candidate to chair this, and I told them that I would at least tentatively agree to do that, and so I am at least the chair through the end of June of this year. The council, through its protocols, are going to be re-electing their slate of officers in June. So myself, Mr. Cox, Darby Nelson, who is another officer, we will have a new election come June.
Big campaign?
No campaign. I characterize it as drawing the short straw.
Mr. Kilgore, or Dr. Kilgore, you talked about the regional Bowser-led listening sessions. Could the information from those listening sessions be made available to this committee?
Madam Chair and members, absolutely. It is on the website. Mr. Jaski is here, and they certainly can.
They'll get the information to Mr. Chen, and then he'll distribute it to this committee. Thank you. The $7.7 million that you decided to set aside in reserve, and because we didn't know how much money is going to come in this first year, how did you arrive at that 10%?
Madam Chair and members, no magical number. We just knew that from the time we met on December 1st and received a briefing from the Department of Finance on the projected revenue going into the fund to the time we received the latest projection, that amount had changed by, I believe, around $6 to $7 million. And so, given that, we felt it was prudent to have at least a 10% reserve to accommodate any further downturn in the projected revenues going into the fund. But there was no magic number. It was just what we felt was a sufficient reserve.
Mr. Becker.
Bill Becker, Madam Chair. Assistant Executive Director of the Council. Also, we've taken some steps in terms of delaying reimbursement and delaying the date at which certain closings can take place to slow the cash flow out of the account. We've done a cash flow analysis, which we can get to you. It's rather rough, but I think it's accurate. It shows precisely what the cash position is each month.
Okay. I'd appreciate seeing that because I'm very apprehensive. I have apprehensions about how much money is going to come in, and I think a larger reserve is better than running out. But Representative Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kilgore, I really appreciated the point that you made that the council was guided by science, and I was just really curious that if I were interested in looking up the different studies or surveys or research that it's based on, would I find that information on your website, or can I get that information?
Madam Chair and Representative Brown, yes. All of our plans that we reviewed are available on the website, and I guess I'll put a caveat. Bill, are there any that you know of that we received that are not on the website?
Mr. Becker.
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that question. I'll get back to you with it. There may be some of the specific, species-specific plans that haven't been posted. They should all be there, but I have to check.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Kilgore, I kind of started looking at, I know the bill isn't really before us, but I started looking at some of the funding and I got a little, I'm not going to say upset, but a little concerned about part of it. One of it is the LCMR has very successfully used the reimbursement process, and I don't think anyone has ever run into problems with that. And I noticed that at least in part of this, you're using an advance instead of a reimbursement. Then what's wrong with going to the time-proven reimbursement process?
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, if you may, I'd like to defer that question to Mr. Bill Becker, who put together that part of the appropriations language, because I couldn't answer that question.
Okay. And then on the same point, I think it may be with this, I was a little concerned when I suddenly looked at, particularly in kind of violation of our second principle, where we're looking at using established channels versus looking at this going to a private firm in Washington, and why wouldn't we just go through this with a whole extra layer of oversight to the DNR? And why wouldn't we just go through the DNR?
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, either Mr. Becker or myself can answer that question. So maybe the first question first?
It's kind of related. Both in the same thing.
Well, Madam Chair.
Mr. Becker.
Representative Kahn, let's talk just very briefly about advances. There are advances to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and then there are advances to this foundation you're referring to, the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. The advance to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is done in order to not have to pay indirect expenses. This is something that other entities, state entities, have done, and I have, in fact, authorized these kinds of advances. They go into a fund that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has and then go to projects. The other advance is to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Foundation. It's a three-part advance. I can't remember the precise date. As you know, they are managing on a reimbursement basis. These advances are to allow them to reimburse grant recipients. So it's not clearly an advance in the sense that you might think about it normally. The work will have been done, by and large.
Representative Tan.
Well, Madam Chairman and Mr. Deck, I'll have to go back and read it more thoroughly so you can change your thinking about how. But I don't certainly don't object to the advance position whenever I serve a position when there's a good reason for it. But as I was reading it, besides the money that goes to this national, whatever its name is, but they are making their grants as advances rather than on a reimbursement basis. That was the second. Well, you know, I just have problems with this multiple levels of how we're going to be granting it.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Becker.
Representative Kahn, I have to reread it. That was not my intent when I drafted the bill.
Well, I'll check it. Please go back to it.
Madam Chair.
Dr. Kilgore.
Representative Kahn, in response to your question of why the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, Don Waggy here?
He's on an airplane.
Okay. The National Fish and Wildlife Foundation is a 501c3 created by Congress 25 years ago. The Lessard Council, looked at a variety of options before making this recommendation. We approached the Board of Water and Soil Resources. We approached the Department of Natural Resources. We looked at the Department of Administration. We contacted other foundations, Southwest Area Foundation, I believe the McKnight Foundation. The reason we are recommending the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, by the way, they have an office here. It's created by Congress, but they are actually housed at Fort Snelling, and I wish Mr. Waggy, their executive director, could be here to explain it. They are the cheapest in terms of the cost of administering this program relative to the others. When we contacted the Board of Water and Soil Resources, they said, we do soil and water protection work on private lands. We really don't do work on public lands. When we contacted the Department of Natural Resources, two issues came up. One is, we do largely work on public lands, but more importantly, there would be a perceived conflict, if not a real conflict of interest, because the lands that would be required to have this restoration, protection, and enhancement work on has to be permanently protected either through state or public ownership or as conservation easement. So if the Department of Natural Resources was administering the program, they would also be the beneficiary of that work, and the council felt that could certainly present a conflict of interest in terms of judging multiple requests for funding. The Department of Administration, we looked at that. We felt they did not have the expertise in that area. We contacted foundations, and for a variety of reasons, they weren't either interested in doing this or they wouldn't be able to do it to our level of satisfaction for those reasons of cost effectiveness.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you can answer this, maybe it's to our fiscal analyst, but is there any other place that would give such a large sum of money without hardly any constraints on it to a private foundation, no matter how well equipped they may be to do it, to administer, when we've done similar things? I mean, I'm well acquainted with Wayne Spain's distribution of grants and so forth, and I think the I don't see it as a conflict of interest when we're using this here and the public money for the public purpose. I don't remember ever seeing anything like that in public financing in the state before. And I don't know if someone could help me out if I dismissed them all. But
I bet they can find out more information before the bill, when the bill comes before us, and we can discuss this in more in depth then, rather than this specific thing anymore today. I think that's something that other people have asked for information about too. So I think that more in depth giving us more information about that will be helpful to you. Any other questions? If not, thank you very much for coming before us. We appreciate your work.
Thank you.
And we'll look forward to seeing you when the bill comes up. Okay. House files. I put these following bills on the agenda, not so much because we need great testimony on them, but because the authors asked
specifically to have this committee hear them for a variety of reasons. A couple of them are because they want to use constitutional amendment money. Others are because they have a good idea for our further consideration. We're not going to vote on these bills today. We are going to hear them and set them aside for further consideration at another time, maybe, or not. But there's something unique about each bill, and I thought I should honor the author's request before we proceed on. House File 1262. Representative Josefkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for giving me a chance to present House File 1262 today. The City of Goodview is has been mandated because of the radium levels in their water to put in two radium filtration plants. And those plants filter out radium as well as iron and manganese. They're currently under construction. They're being financed with a PFA 20-year loan. They must come into conformance with the regulations by July 1st of 2009. The total cost of the construction is $4.3 million. Now, the City of Goodview is a town of 3,300 people located right next to Winona, actually adjoins Winona, Winona County. And their annual water fund budget is $400,000. The annual principal and interest on this loan alone is $280,000 a year. And of course, this is a federally mandated from the EPA, carried out locally in Minnesota by the Department of Health. And of course, the first thing that one would ask is, you know, why isn't the federal government paying for their mandate? And as a matter of fact, two different takes on this. First is, the federal government, Congress, did include language to appropriate several different projects with the Water Resources Development Act back in 2007. The only thing they did is they left the money off, and the money never came. And at this point, the City of Goodview, in their persistence in following through with their elected federal representatives, has learned that it's very unlikely that that money will ever come with that authorization. I also asked them to take a look at the economic stimulus money coming from the federal government, because there is monies included in there too. The economic stimulus money, it turns out, is good for projects from the 1st of October of last year, the beginning of the fiscal year for the federal government, through whenever, if it's next October or the following October. They signed the agreement on the development of the facilities 1 week before October 1st of 2008. So they missed the deadline. It was September 22nd when they signed the paper. So as I look at the Article 11, Section 15 of the Constitution from the outdoor amendment and the clean water section, it says at least 5% of the clean water fund must be spent only to protect drinking water resources. And so, Madam Chair and members, I see this as a very good fit there for people who have radium problems in cities. As I understand, the only way to mitigate or protect is to put these types of filtration facilities in. And so that's where the City of Goodview is stuck, and I would ask for your consideration this bill to help them relieve the cost of building those facilities.
Representative, the project started with PFA money, correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct, yes.
And so you're asking for this money to reduce the amount to the people, even though they're getting the project through a PFA loan?
That is correct, Madam Chair. Their water and utility rates have gone up in the last 4 years, 36, 21, 17, and next year 25%. And they don't know how they're going to pay for this. And so this would retire the PFA loan.
So you're asking for constitutional money to retire the PFA loan. Is that constitutional, Representative? Have you checked that out? Would you check that out?
Madam Chair, I will, yes, and I have not. But I didn't see any immediate...
And also please check out if that would put the PFA money in jeopardy.
Okay, I will do, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
House File 1922, Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1922 is a conglomeration of federal stimulus money, clean water money, all these projects. They're often looking for homes or places to be sent to, and this one ended up here. Basically a request for American Recovery and Reinvestment Act dollars or federal stimulus money for the city of Benson to replace one of their wells. In 2008, the number that the second treatment facility, a well, failed and was capped, and so the city of Benson is looking to drill a new well that will go deeper into the lower aquifer versus the middle aquifer to try to mitigate future problems. And so this is just a request for American Recovery Investment dollars to help cover that project for, I believe, $232,000. And in this hustle and mess of figuring out where all these projects would be directed to, the city of Benson asked me just to bring this forward so it would be on the people radar.
And Representative Falk, has the city of Benson talked to the Public Facilities Authority, and do they have a number yet?
I believe they are in the process, and this is what I was told to me. It was brought to my attention very briefly, which is why I apologize for this coming up late in the session. But they had hit a number of projects, and then I got a call one day saying, oops, we forgot about this well project, we hope we can still get it in. And so we're trying to figure out if it will qualify or if it's going to meet the deadlines, but we wanted to go at least present the idea before people.
Well, you did that, Representative Falk, but somebody's got to talk to PFA and Mr. Terry Coleman or Mr. Jeff Freeman or Ms. Nancy Johnson and bring it to their attention, because we couldn't, even if we wanted to, even if we had the stack of stimulus money sitting here, if we wanted to and it hadn't been, it didn't have a PFA number,
right,
we couldn't say, here you are, $233,000.
Right.
So
I will bring your comments back to them and make sure that they have followed through with the PFA.
Thank you. House File 1652, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Is it okay if I take it from here or show you?
You may.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1652 is brought to us from the City of Preston for green elevator restoration. And actually, I would need to change some language on here. It's at a trailhead right on a state trail, the River Trail, in the City of Preston. And currently, the grain elevator itself has been restored, so that would need to be taken off of there. And so the elevators are destroyed. They have a boxcar in there, and they're bringing a caboose in there at the trailhead. And what they want to do is put in a bagging shed, a scale house, and a dock to restore the site to the way it was back in 1916. And there would be a little conference center in there to hold meetings for the area. So that's House File 1652.
Now, are you expecting bonds from, like, capital investments? So would this be on your... Should we forward this on to capital investment for next year, or is this what you're... how you're reading bond proceeds from this committee?
What am I doing?
For the one of the, for one of the funds.
Talking to me?
Mr. Soderberg.
Well, Madam Chair, members, I think this bill is reflective of a question that the committee's going to ask and have to ask themselves on. I think there'll be other bills that do this, and that is that this bill is asking for the bonds to be let, but instead of having the money go through the Capital Investment Committee, it would have the debt servicing for those bonds paid for, the ongoing debt service for those bonds, paid out of one of the Constitutional Amendment funds, specifically the Arts and Cultural Fund.
Madam Chair, that's what I was doing.
And that's a big question that we're going to have to talk about.
Madam Chair, this will be the test.
And this is the test, yeah.
And Madam Chair, if that doesn't work, then I would change the language to Senator.
Then we'll send it on up.
Well,
we have time.
Madam Chair,
we have time to discuss this, and this is why I asked you to hang on, because we do have to discuss that before the bill on the constitutional amendment money passes out of here. We have to come to a determination. So, House File 1208, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is setting up a statewide regional arts capital fund where arts groups from around the state, other than the, I believe it's the 7-County Metro, could come in. And I do know that this money is out of the Cultural Heritage Fund for capital loans on $4 million a year each year, each of the 5 years being fiscal year 2010 for a total of $20 million. Groups could come in then, the outstate groups, if you will, could come in and borrow money to either build, renovate arts facilities in their communities.
Representative Loeffler, Madam Chair, and Representative Davis, I liked your first introduction better. This is for a statewide fund. I think that's the way we should think about this. I have a 1920s Art Deco theater in my district that has been awaiting for over 20 years an opportunity to come to life again, and it's on one of the historic preservation registers because it's really beautiful and unique. It's just looking for a source of the right kind of dollar.
And Madam Chair,
Red Genius has one of those too, I'm told.
Representative Davis.
We have one. There.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Loeffler. I'm sure a simple amendment could take care of that on line 1.8.
And this is a, like, once the fund is then. The money is paid off, then the money goes back into the fund, and then some other projects can be funded from that,
Madam
right?
Chair, it's a revolving loan fund, so they'd be paid back at 3% interest, and then another group could apply with the funds that have been repaid.
And what is your vision of how they're going to get the money in 5 years?
Madam Chair, who's going to get the money?
The
money comes in from the Cultural Heritage Fund to the Arts Capital Loan Fund that we would have just been established, $4 million a year for 5 years, $20 million, and then it would be run. Folks would come in, or groups would come in, groups would come in and get loans and then pay them back, and then other groups would come in later and reapply. Or not reapply, could apply for new money that come in for the repayment. Really good idea.
And then we wouldn't take money out of that until the whole $20 million is in there.
Well, Madam Chair, it would be my intent that we'd start right away with the first $4 million that came in. We'd start right away, but rather than just taking a chunk of $20 million right up front, we want to get it established, use that $4 million right up front each year, and then as money comes back in from the payment, that would be additional money that could be used.
It'll be fun.
It's been an intriguing idea. Thank you very much for bringing it to our attention.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Let's continue the discussion.
And, Madam Chair, that's also one where we have to figure out what we're doing.
Yes, I can. House File 1570, Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I don't have a bill before you asking for any money out of cultural outdoor heritage tax. Instead, I've got what Representative Hawes would call an interesting little bill related to allowing regional libraries to charge non-residents for a library card. And, Madam Chair, if I can, I know you know this history well, but I'll take just a minute to give the background. Last year, when I was president of the council in Duluth, we went through a significant budget deficit, and part of that process was prioritization of our funding. And one of the things that happened to fall lower on the list was libraries. And so we took some substantial reductions to our library in Duluth. And as you may suspect, I heard a lot from folks. And what surprised me was I heard a lot from folks that don't actually live in the city of Duluth. Over half of my contacts on our Western Library were from folks that lived in neighboring cities and in townships. I decided to dig into that a little bit, and I had been the representative for the council and the library board for a couple of terms, and knew a little bit, but not enough, and learned about county and integrated library systems where the support for the library is spread across the entire service area. But in northeastern Minnesota, we have what is more of a federated system in which individual libraries are members. So county taxpayers contribute a little bit towards the regional system, and that helps support the regional system, but it doesn't actually flow back to the core library, in this case, Duluth. So my motivation, Madam Chair, as you know, in bringing this forward is that I'm an avid user of our library. I'm aware that in a down economy, more people, not less, use the library, the computer services. They're not shopping at Barnes & Noble and places like that. And the purpose of my bill is to highlight library funding inequities, especially in a time of scarce resources. So, members, as you look at the actual bill, it would allow cities of the first and second class outside the metropolitan area this voluntary option. That's nine communities. Those communities, as I know you're aware, are Faribault, Owatonna, Mankato, Austin, Rochester, Moorhead, St. Cloud, Winona, and Duluth. But, Madam Chair, my hope today is that you'd lay this bill over pending what I hope will be a legislative auditor's report on library funding. And, members, if you haven't done your form yet, we got another reminder. And item number six is the Minnesota Library System, and I'd encourage you to check that one. And, Madam Chair, I have met with the Minnesota Library Association, and we're both hoping for this report and to continue work during the interim on additional sources of support for our libraries in Minnesota.
And, Representative Reiner, this committee is going to do some independent work over the interim and talk to various libraries in their regions and get some ideas. There have been several committees talking about funding of libraries throughout the years, and more people have contacted me and said, I was on a committee that talked about this, and we made some recommendations. And so I think it's time to get all those committee reports out and in the hands of the legislative auditor too, and maybe we can have a more transparent system of statewide funding of libraries, and more of a we can certainly look at the equity that was brought to our attention, or lack of equity that was brought to our attention during our conversations on the maintenance of effort. And so we indeed will hold this over.
Excellent. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Reinhardt, I was just wondering how the fee system would work. When they check a book out, when they enter the library, how would that work?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative, we actually have an example in Duluth since we're a border city. The folks from Superior, Wisconsin, who use the library actually get charged an annual fee. It's $50. My suggested proposal was maybe $5 an individual or $25 a family as an annual fee.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Reddit, well, how would we know that they are not residents? So they have like a photo ID or something?
They wear a big red S. No, the photo ID is for the to vote at the Historical Society's annual meeting.
Oh.
Representative Loeffler. Thank you, Representative Reinhardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, I just wanted to say that I'm sorry, you had a...
Well, whenever.
She doesn't have a question.
Representative Reinhardt, I would assume as in the cities that you were naming off, Duluth must charge non-resident fees in quite a few activities, do they not?
Representative Haas, traditionally, no. We've understood that being a regional center, part of what you do is bring folks in. And certainly we understand that we get sales tax revenue from being a regional center. So, you know, again, the issue is, my intent here is to try to highlight the issue, and I appreciate Madam Chair's forthrightness and wanting to bring together some things, perhaps independently of the legislative auditor.
And I also use the library, Duluth Library, avidly, as well as the Cloquet Library, and I'm on the Friends of the Library, and I also contribute to the Library Foundation.
Yeah.
And the other Saturday, when I went to the library, I spent $48 at the grocery store in Duluth, and I bought gas for $32. At the gas station in Duluth. And so, you know, there's all kinds of things we have to consider if we're going to think about fees for library charge. No. But we're going to talk about it in the future. And Representative Reinhardt can be part of the mix.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I haven't given my speech about the Andrew Carnegie Free Library.
No.
That started at the turn of the century, and all the libraries that were built to be free to the people of America forever, as long as the Carnegie Library stood. And the remains of our Carnegie Library are, you know, in jeopardy, and so we have to talk. You know, they took the Tiffany window out of the Carnegie Library, and there were some suggestions that we should sell it to the highest bidder this year, or the Duluth should sell it to the highest bidder because they're in real financial difficulty. And you think, oh my God, that was part of the Andrew Carnegie Library, where it was supposed to be free. But sometimes you have to think of some things. Whoever thought that the library would have movies and things that you could pick up and that are in competition with the local store down the street. So maybe we have to think of something differently. And so Representative Reinhardt's bringing that to our attention, that we got to start thinking.
Mm.
Representative Haas.
Thank you. Well, many regional centers such as St. Cloud, certainly not in the library, but in recreational programs and swimming pools or whatever it happens to be, are the inside the city, and the people living on the outside then just come to the inside and use those and then go back out and live in an area where the taxes aren't quite as high. The taxes aren't quite as high out there because the programs are not being offered. So non-resident...
Excuse me for interrupting.
Sure.
In my case, that's not quite the same.
Yeah,
because
I imagine it differs in different areas.
Some communities that are cash cows for the county.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah, some are sacrificial lambs also, but you know. another. Yeah, that was very moving. But anyway, another area that you'll find of, I thought you would, might find of interest in the Council of Aging programs. Every program they run gives an opportunity for their client or their user to provide a donation. Every program the Council on Aging runs gives an opportunity for the person that serves it to make a donation. Not have to, but to make a donation. And I think that is actually a fairly nice way of doing things. And I'm now old enough mm-hmm. to qualify for their programs, and I do make a donation.
And the Duluth Library has a thing like that that you can put in. It's pretty safe, clear, and it always has money in it that people have put in for that day.
Yep.
Representative, thank you, Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative,
Madam Chair, I wondered if you have already stopped by the Rangers party.
No way. Representative Loeffler. It is time first. Today is a historic occasion for someone whose company and work we enjoy, who through his first assignment demonstrated his love of our outdoors and its waters and habitats, and in true expression of our cultural traditions, we should always still turn our best on his birthday. Thank you. Representative Mack, do you have the minutes?
I do. I have approval of the minutes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes of the 86th session, the 19th meeting, are approved. Tomorrow morning at 10:30, I will visit with the Republicans, Representative David's office, and I will meet with the Democrats. And 236? Okay. Well, we will meet with the Democrats. Mr. Chen will put it on the email at 8 o'clock. This meeting is adjourned.